The following audio was recorded at the Pacific School Leadership Institute, which was held October 21 and 22, 2021, at Waits Lake Open Bible Camp near Valley, Washington.
There's a saying that goes, "Truth is stranger than fiction because fiction has to make sense." Think about that. Biographies are truth, and to some of you, maybe thinking of the word biography, it conjures up images in your mind of a dusty bookshelf and a big tome that's about 500 pages long and thick, and it's like gives you a migraine almost just to think about or to look at it. But I want you today to get a different picture of biographies. These books can help to change your view of that. Why should we read biographies? How many of you, when you go to pick up a book, the first thing you're like, "Oh yes, I want to read a biography." Would anybody raise their hand? Some people might. Jonathan almost did. That's kind of what we think of biographies sometimes, but I want to give three things why I think we should read biographies. They are real life. They can teach valuable lessons on the consequences of our choices because they are about real life and about people that have experienced real life. And they can inspire us to work harder and climb higher because, again, they're about real life. And so the things you read in a biography actually happened. And remember what I said, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, because fiction must make sense. These books are put out by an organization called YWAM, which is a pretty neat acronym in my opinion. It sounds pretty forceful. And YWAM stands for Youth with a Ministry, and they give these three things as their main goals. One, to training and equipping believers for their part in fulfilling the Great Commission. Two, personal evangelism. And three, mercy ministry, which is medical and relief work. These books are all under the heading Christian Heroes, Then and Now. And they focus on heroes of faith from history. They're written by Janet and Jeff Benge. I don't know if I'm saying their names exactly right, but they're a writing team, a couple, and they've had about 30 years of writing experience, so they're written by veteran authors, as Paul said. They're biographies, but they're geared for younger audiences. And if you look through them, they each are about 200 pages long, so you can read them in one sitting if you're a fairly fast reader. But they don't take long to read. And they lack that intimidating factor that might come to your mind when you hear the word biography. I would highly recommend these books. I found in the little bit of reading that I did in them that they're very engaging, even though they are biographies. And even as an adult, I found them very interesting, the ones that I read in. And another reason I would highly recommend these is because I believe these are the type of people, these men and women are the type of people that our children should be looking up to. Do you know who your children's heroes are? Are your children, do they have heroes of like sports figures or hunting heroes or whatever? Who do they look up to? Do they look up to men and women who have sacrificed their lives for God? These books cover a wide range of men and women. I just have three here: Cameron Townsend, Richard Wurmbrand, and Sundar Singh. You may or may not recognize those names. Probably we've all heard of Amy Carmichael. Probably we've all heard of Hudson Taylor and Elizabeth Elliot. Some of those are more common names. But how many of you have heard of Eric Little? Okay, a few of you had. He was a man from Great Britain, Scotland. And he was a runner, very fast runner. And he was a dedicated Christian. And he got to the Olympics and found out that one of the things that he was going to run in at the Olympics, they were going to hold one of the qualifying heats on Sunday. He refused to run, and so he ended up running in a different race that wasn't held on Sunday, and he did win that race. But that's just one example of a Christian hero that I don't have his book here, but he is in this series. There's other names like Norman Grubb, Adoniram Judson, Claus Dieter John. I don't even know who all those people were, but they were Christian heroes. I'm going to give you just a couple specific glimpses from the book about Amy Carmichael. How does a girl's school some fish line and a comet go together in Amy's life. How did Amy become Amma, or the Indian word for mother, to hundreds of children even though she never was married? And what was the starry cluster in Amy's life? Those are some questions that can be answered by reading her biography. So these are biographies. Think about this with me. What would your biography look like if someone was to sit down and write your biography in a 200-page book? What would it look like? And maybe more importantly even, since we're thinking about school and our children, what would their biographies look like? And what are they writing in their biographies now? At $10 a piece, you can get these books that can help to shape the lives of your children and help them as they write their own biography. May our children all be YWAM children, Youth with a Ministry.
One story I love about Eric Little is when he was out with his daughters walking and a rabbit jumped up and he ran the rabbit down and caught it and took it home and ate it. This book that I have is Teaching with Love and Logic by Jim Fay and David Funk. As a teacher, certainly one of the most, or some of the most stressful opportunities that I have faced, and I bet most teachers have faced, involve discipline. And it's stressful for many reasons. We tend to get emotionally involved in power struggles as teachers. We can become obsessed with controlling our students' behaviors. And we also care. We care about the students. And this book is full of practical advice on dealing with conflict in school. It's not just in school, but in school. And I believe the ideas that are put forward in this book will help students develop logical thinking and will really help them to own their decisions and consequences as well. And it directs teachers on how to step back from making a decision on discipline in the heat of the moment, allows us to step back without ignoring infractions. And as I read this book, there were so many scenes from my teaching came back to me. Many, many bad scenes, really probably most of them were not resolved well. And when you read this book, there will be so many takeaways from it because it is just packed full of all kinds of situations in schools. And there's just so much involved. And I can't begin to take all the facts, but I have a couple here. One is the three-legged table. He calls it a three-legged table. I think there would be maybe a better paradigm, but that's the one he used. And he says these three things that children should have in a school. As I understand, three things. One is that I am loved by what he calls the magic people in my life, the people who have authority over me, so that would be my parents. In our situation, it would be our parents, our teachers, and maybe we could say the people in our church. I'm loved for who I am, not for what I can do. I'm loved by the magic people. Second point was I know more about my struggles, my strengths, than I do my weaknesses. School often reveals our weaknesses. You did this wrong. Try again. But we also need to know, we need to give to our students their strengths. We need to show them their strengths. This is where you did well. This is work harder on this as well. And also that I can handle the consequences of my behavior. When I make a mistake, I can fix it. I can go make restitution. And part of it is because it talks about offering choices. If we can offer good choices to our students, that is a big benefit over just offering them bad choices. If we make a demand on them, it's either do this or else. In order to win that power struggle, the only way that they can win is to make a bad choice because we own the good choice, right? And we become involved in power struggles. Somebody has said once, if you can choose, if a student can choose between looking bad or looking stupid, he will choose bad every time. Okay, because nobody wants to look stupid, and it's not quite so bad to be bad as it is to be stupid. Somebody told me to, as a beginning teacher, make sure pick your battles, but make sure you win your battles, and that was true, too. But this book really illustrates the first part of that statement, that you choose your battles very carefully, and you choose your statements carefully, too, not to escalate conflict. When there's a problem, you don't escalate the conflict, but you can resolve it. One, just so many illustrations here, but I'd like to read one. Let's say that a student wants to turn in his homework late, and he feels that he has a good reason for doing so. So a battle response would be to say, you know the rules, I don't want to talk about it anymore. And that is a conflict statement. Is it wrong to say that? What if you would say, well, I'll give full credit for papers that are turned in on time? Or would you rather turn your paper in on time and get full credit or get partial credit later? Or you can show sadness. Must be frustrating to do the work and not get full credit. What a bummer. So in that, you're not really backing down. You're not being a pushover. But you're attempting to get the student to own their decision a little bit. Wes Weaver has these books on display back there. And there are two editions. I read this one. This is, I believe, the 1995 copyright. And he has one that's a 2016 edition. And I believe he says the new one is improved. So he has them both back there.
I am here to introduce the book, Handbook for Creative Teaching, written by David L. Martin, copyrighted in 1986 by Rod and Staff Publishers. At the beginning of this book, we have a very thorough index, which makes this book a great resource. It's easy to browse subjects that you are interested in. You can easily find those chapters in the table of contents. In the back of the book, pages 903 to 930, is a very detailed index, which helps you find specific information on short notice for specific situations. If we would look in the index on thinking, a subheading, hindrances to, it would point us to chapter 25 on how students block their own thinking. We'll take a sample from that. So the student forgets to think in simple steps. I don't understand the directions, says Winford. What don't you understand? The whole thing. That hints at what his problem must be, whether it is following directions, figuring out a reading problem in math, sounding out a word or spelling amphitheater. Children can make it a lot easier for themselves by taking it one step at a time. To help Winford's immediate problem, say, start by doing what you can. You're working on part A, aren't you? Write an A on your paper. Now write one. You're ready to go. Read the first sentence of your directions. Do you know how to follow those directions for number one? Then do it. Now read the next sentence. Or we could look in the index under slow student, the subheading respect for. That would take us to chapter 29. 60 ways to help a slow learner. The second way is cultivating a good attitude, not just technique. We'll take a few samples from this. Take pleasure in a slow child's small steps. They count as much as big steps count for a fast learner. Consider the saying, never undervalue anyone. The workman loves not to have his work despised in his presence. God is present everywhere, and every person is his work. Consider that many people start out slow who later make a tremendous contribution to the world. Jesus' own disciples make excellent examples. At various times they disappointed him. Once he asked, "How is it that you do not understand?" Again he asked, "Have I not been so long time with you, and yet hast thou not known me, Philip?" Yet the master teacher was amazingly patient because he knew God had a future for his disciples. God has a future for your slow learners, too. Or we could look under the index, in the index under classroom atmosphere, the subheading of mutual respect. And that would take us to chapter 51 on keeping respect and goodwill. It's part of the job. Interesting, is it not, that if you're a teacher, part of your job is to enjoy your job? A bricklayer can despise his bricks and still put up a decent wall, but you cannot really do a good job of teaching unless you enjoy your job and your students. All's well that ends well. It is strange, but the last 20 minutes of a day can help determine how you feel about the whole day. If a problem comes up at the last minute and afterwards you do not think you handled it right, you feel dissatisfied about the whole day, even if, on the whole, it went quite well. It works the same way for your students. To be sure, all is not necessarily well that ends well, but since it feels that way, try to plan the day, particularly the last 20 minutes, so that everyone leaves smiling. Or we could look in the index under discipline problems, under the subheading of forgetting, that would take us to chapter 56. This chapter is on getting their want-to working. So teaching methods of self-discipline. Show them how. Some teachers bear down on a student to make him want to do better, when if they would only show him how to do better, he would want to without so much outside pressure. If a student always forgets to take his excuse card home to get it signed, you need not punish him necessarily. You could tie a string to his finger, but that is humiliating. It would be better to simply tell him to put the excuse card in his lunchbox where someone is sure to find it before tomorrow. Best of all, ask, "Where are you going to put it so you won't forget it?" For those in school administration, this book will give you valuable insights for the situations and questions that arise. It is also a very valuable resource to point your young teachers to when they come to you for questions.